charge whatever they want for an ambulance ride. And they make up some figure. This costs us this much plus this much, blah, blah, blah. So now ambulance rides can cost you a huge amount of money, and your insurance company might not cover them if they go to the wrong hospital, or might not cover them at all. You might not have insurance. Can you imagine? This country, you know, it's such a contradiction, because on the one hand, American working class people have fought for bravely, historically, for many things. You know, think of the people that volunteered in the Civil War. And there were some, people want to erase this, but there were some that were voluntary specifically to get rid of slavery, and they fought. Especially the influx of black people who had been slaves, who just left the plantations and went and joined the Union Army and fought to, you know, fought down and beat down the Confederacy, right? To the amazing union movements that have happened, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, all sorts of movements, the suffragette movement, all sorts of movements by working class people in America to win basic freedoms, to point to at least, or even talk about socialism and pay a heavy price for it, et cetera. There's a lot to be proud of, actually, if you're an American working class person, or anyone that, any, if working class person anywhere, that includes the struggle of the working class in America as part of the international struggle of the working class. But on the other hand, I sit here in America and I just wonder, you know, like a lot of other people, why are we taking this? Why are people taking this? Why? You know? And I kind of know a lot of the answers why. Don't know all the answers, obviously. But I know a lot of the answers why. Because of being able to use a socialist Marxist analysis to figure out the material role of the corporate media in propping up the system, the corporate duopoly over politics, Democratic Party, Republican Party, and the policies they support. I mean, there was almost single-payer health care, which wouldn't have solved everything, would have been a great step forward. In California, Democrats had the votes for it. Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, Jerry Brown, and others were not for it, and they pulled the plug on it through a legal maneuver, and it never went to ballot. It never got implemented. And now the Democrats are defending that, you know, where they are challenged on it. There's a lot of them defending that. Oh, it wasn't the right time, whatever. Yeah, okay. Meanwhile, people are getting dumped out of hospitals, thrown on the street. Like that woman in Baltimore, 21-year-old woman, I guess, or young woman. And that went viral on Facebook, you know. And the hospital did apologize in that case. I'm not sure that the other case I talked about, anyone apologized. Anyway, if you're in the Worcester area, more just feel like driving, little commute, come out to Worcester on February 7th, 2 p.m. meeting at Worcester State University, Wesleyan, Wasleyan Hall, Seven Hills Conference Room, to hear Toya Chester speak on Me Too and a new women's movement. And then 7 p.m. at Clark University that night at Jonas Clark, room 001. Jonas Clark's this big building with a clock on it. See it when, if you're facing Worcester, if you're facing Clark University, it's right in front of you. After I'll take a quick break here, we'll get into some of the topics that will be discussed at these meetings and that are in material of Socialist Alternative, and you can find it probably in other places as well, some of the same similar ideas at least. But we're gonna take a quick musical interlude here, and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Take a long walk through a company town. On what used to be solid ground. Nobody was ever gonna get sized down. Pledging allegiance. When all those dollars they headed south. Taking the food right out of the baby's mouth. Down in Mexico they don't complain as loud. Pledging allegiance. Gun and teach him how to shoot. Teach him to shoot. 130 will fry an egg, and it will take the skin right off of your legs. But the sidewalk is still the place to beg a pledging allegiance. Between the lines of those stars and stripes, the fine print says that we got some rights to a steam grate on the coldest night. Pledging allegiance. Pledging allegiance.
You're listening to WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. Also known as Tufts, free-form, commercial-free, community-based radio, 91.5 FM, WMFO.
We're not here to make you great, my friends. We're just here to make America shake again. Come on, you're not gonna build a wall, much less build a fence. Can't get too much into that in a 3-minute song. Our job's just to play for you and hope you sing along. Just a band playing for time. Dropping the hammer in iambic pentameter and multi-syllabic rhyme. This country seems whiskey bent and hellbound for an accident. But over here at BSHQ,
You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we heard some music, Wake Up Call by Michael Veach, and a song called Pledging Allegiance. I really like that song, except for that one line about something about Mexico, money went south, so they're not protesting as much or something. I don't know. They're quieter. I don't know. I just didn't like that part that much, but the rest of it was okay. And then we had Big State, an album called Sure Thing with a song called Make America Shake Again. That was pretty good. And I'm testing out some new music here. Regular listeners of the show know that I will play, if allowed by my co-hosts, I will play a lot of the same music over and over again. I'm really into that. I'm really into sort of repetition and learning a song really well, then moving on to something else. And also, it's because I don't have all, you know, I don't know, I don't have all the time in the world to explore music. I love music, but I used to be really into it. I used to go to shows and all that. And I used to, you know, dance, you know, at clubs and all that stuff. Don't do that anymore. So my access is a bit limited, you know, to get through the workday. Since I'm on a computer a lot, I do find some music here and there that I really like. But again, I tend to go to explore deeper people I already knew about. So, for example, lately at work, I've been really looking deeper into Joni Mitchell's work. And, you know, she's got a political side to her. A lot of people don't know about, but it's there if you dig for it. Or she did. But she's not looking for political music. I'm looking for also for Joni Mitchell, everything. Everything is in her music. She's a true, brilliant, universal artist, whatever stupid cliches I'm coming up with here to describe her work. It's just phenomenal music. And so I'll find myself digging into that to get through the day of exploitation of my labor, and then not exploring newer stuff. So that's a dichotomy or whatever. That's a dilemma. I would like to hear, I do like new music, do hear a lot of good new music. It's like someone we were talking with some friends and acquaintances and so on about rap music recently, and you know, I'm older and like, well, why, you know, they just assumed I didn't like rap music, I think. I was like, no, you know, actually it's brilliant. I mean, rap is a brilliant sort of music methodology in its essence. You know, I love rhyming, I love the beats, I love the creativity of it, the spontaneity of it in some cases, although a lot of it is, of course, honed to perfection, really worked on hard. And you know, that's taking into account all the dreck, all the commercialized rap and so on. But still, you know, what started the discussion was whatever happened to Dead Prez, basically, I think was what started that discussion. And I was reassured they're still around and touring. But it's just with less... no, it wasn't Dead Prez. It was Public Enemy, I think. And it was like they're still touring just, you know, smaller venues, you know, smaller, less people into them, whatever, which is a shame, but not a crippling thing. It might even be a more liberating thing for the music and for the rap and so on. But, you know, so I was saying, like, I love rap, you know, but I just don't get exposed to it a lot. Don't have time. Don't have time to search it out, look for it. We play it on the show sometimes. and yeah, so that's true of a lot of different things, a lot of different genres. The work week is too long, the commute is too long. You know, we're not free. We're not free. Wage slaves are not free. A lot of us think we're free. We're not. Our time is not our own. When you're selling labor, when you're selling your labor, you know, if you read any Marxist economics, that's broken down into different parts in a way. Not different parts, but like there's different ways of measuring labor. So sometimes in political economy, influenced by Marxism or Marxist political economy, the time that you sell to the capitalist is measured in labor time, but also sometimes measured in labor power. Like you're being exploited. A lot of people think they're being exploited for a specific skill. What's your skill set and all that? Well, then you get into a job and you find out, hey, wait a minute, they're messing with that. I was hired to do this and I'm actually doing that. I was hired to do X, I'm actually doing Y. The capitalists are constantly trying to dumb down production make training as minimal as possible or make it DIY, you know, so they don't have to add that as a cost for their greediness, their bottom line. Greed monitor, short-term expectation of profit, profit rates always going up. That's their gods, and they don't want anything to get in the way of that. And quality, certainly quality, is not a concern, believe it or not, for capitalists. It just isn't. They can say it is, but it's not, because they'll immediately find cheaper components or cheaper ways of producing something, and they'll jump on it in a second. It's like this thing with solar power. Trumpolino, whatever you want to call him, and some things I can't say on the air about him, just did another favor for big business, for this case, one section of big business against a smaller section. He did something that he thought would help, or they did something in the Trump regime they thought would help the fossil fuel industry, you know, the old oil companies and so on, by putting a tariff, excuse me, on solar panels. And so that's really bad. But, excuse me, a lot of the things written in response or said in response to that, against that, have accepted actually the logic of the Trump administration to a certain extent. So Trump is assuming that this tariff will be a decisive blow to the solar industry. But this is all predicated upon the idea that there's a certain, accelerating rate of profit must always be in place for the companies producing solar technology, using solar panels, okay? And since they are produced cheaper in China, supposedly, and that's where a lot of them started to come from within the last few years, then there's no way for an American company to produce solar panels here, because they would just be, quote, too expensive. Well, whenever you hear that, whenever you hear the shibboleths, the cliches of capitalism, capitalist propaganda, are often the money's not there, it's too expensive, all that kind of stuff. It's not true. It's not true. They're making conscious decisions about where to spend money to make more money. So the money's not there because they've shifted it. They've moved into someplace they think can make more money. So there could be a company right here in Massachusetts, and there was, and there maybe still is, companies, let's say, that all of a sudden decide to start producing solar panels. Here's the catch. They're not going to make as high of profit as they did with the Chinese solar panels, imported Chinese solar panels, because the so far at least, this is changing all the time, but the socially acceptable sort of wages and so on, well, mainly wages, are just higher than they are in China right now. By socially acceptable, I'm just sort of using shorthand for throwing in, you know, there's a legal minimum wage here. There are some labor laws that might just be enforced. You never know. That will create a wage floor that is higher than the wage floor in China. Okay. And therefore, the cost of production through wages will just be, and maybe economies of scale in general, meaning in China, they've got things up and running on a huge level on solar panels. They'd have to restart here. That would be some costs. Or they have to accelerate here. That would be some costs in other non-labor costs. But adding the non-labor costs and the labor costs together, you can still churn out solar panels and make a profit. Problem is, it'd be a lower profit. Not as much of a profit, at least in the beginning, as the Chinese solar panels. Even with the tariffs helping you, so-called, you probably would not make as high a profit as you would using the Chinese solar panels. But that does not stop. Think about what I'm saying carefully. That doesn't mean you can't still make a profit. You could. And I'm not defending profit mongering or profit making under capitalism. I'm just saying, by their own terms, they could have a solar industry here. Yeah. And I've seen people on the left even make the mistake of saying, no, it's impossible. There's only one way to produce solar panels now, and that's through China. That's not true. We should never accept the parameters of capitalism. But then you find out times that even within the parameters of capitalism, they're telling all sorts of lies. You know, you could have it immediately. You could have immediately a solar industry in Massachusetts, but it would have to be capitalists that were willing to accept a lower rate of profit or lower agri-profits, maybe, in the short term than what they get from China and what shook out in the industry in the last 5 to 10 years. Because there was originally, remember, there were solar panels being produced, I think in Danvers, right here in Massachusetts and other places. And then when China ramped it up, it all went over there. Because the capitalists are always chasing the cheapest labor. You know, it's not like labor's expensive in the United States. Labor's damn cheap right now for the capitalists in the United States. But the capitalists are chasing the cheapest labor because they want maximization of profit. If they're not making the biggest profits they think they can make, then they will leave that industry even though they are making profits. Everyone thinks capitalists are closing down because they're not making profits. It's usually they're closing down because they see they can make bigger profits, or they think they can, somewhere else. That includes, by the way, financial speculation. A lot of the tax cuts that are happening through the Trump gift to the greedy less than 1%, the tax gift, that to the big corporations, that money's going to go to, a lot of it's going to go to financial speculation, where the capitalist accountants are basically assuring their bosses that, yes, you're going to make a higher rate of return through speculating on currencies and other financial speculation than you will through setting up another, say, manufacturing plant or hotel or whatever. So part of it will go to that, you know. Part of the profits that could have got plowed back into some sort of investment that would create jobs, supposedly. Create jobs is a problematic way of putting that, but let's just go with it for a second. That's not going to be done, or it's not going to be done as much. Capitalists, as long as they control the profits, the surplus value from our labor, they are then not only allowed, but they are encouraged to do whatever they want with that money. And it doesn't mean reinvesting in anything useful, necessarily. Most of the time, that's the case. It just invest in something that will make the most profits. Anyway, let's get back to the women's movement thing. Again, public meetings coming up in Worcester, Massachusetts. Wednesday, February 7th, Worcester State University, 2 p.m., Wesleyan Hall, Seven Hills Conference Room, Clark University, 7 p.m., Jonas Clark Building, room 001. For more information, get in touch with, on Facebook, Worcester Socialist Alternative. Oh, you can even call 508-864-5006, 508-864-5006. And just a little bit from the leaflet here, the mass outrage expressed in the Me Too campaign is an empowering movement for the still brewing new women's movement. We need to move to the next step. Have a self-organized women's movement fighting with disruptive tactics to win victories. A new women's movement must take on the issues of sexual harassment, gender-based violence, reproductive rights, parental leave, child care, and the pay gap. Working class women's needs should be at the forefront, at the center of a rebuilt women's movement. Safe, decent, affordable housing, higher wages, and Medicare for all are also critical demands for women, and demands that are diametrically opposed to the interests of the big business, the big corporations, and the political establishment. With the millions who came out into the streets the day after Trump's inauguration, there should be no doubt that there's a powerful mass consciousness of the need to fight against gender inequality, to fight for gender equality. Another side of the leaflet. Me Too, socialist feminism, the worldwide women's struggle. Me Too is the latest women's action in a string of events globally that points towards an explosive mood against sexism and the billionaire-dominated political establishment. The mass outrage expressed in the Me Too campaign is an empowering movement for the still brewing new women's movement. We need to move to the next step and have an self-organized women's movement fighting with disruptive tactics to win victories. That was from the first page as well. As capitalism pushes workers back on so many fronts around the world, a global women's movement is emerging. And while sections of the political establishment may pay lip service to women's equality, they represent an economic system whose foundations are built on class, race, and gender exploitation, just like the world of big Hollywood movies. Only a socialist society based on radical egalitarianism can bring an end once and for all to the reign of all the Harvey Weinsteins. And if you attend these meetings or look up, go to socialistalternative.org, get the latest paper of Socialist Alternative, you'll see concrete demands we're putting forward some concrete demands that we think would bring the struggle that's developing forward and get some real gains for women including working class and poor women. Poor is the same as working class as far as we're concerned, but, you know. Now, one of the things that happened in the women's movement last week, which was, let me just preface it. You're going to hear some criticism here, in a way, of the leadership. But let me preface it by saying that Social Alternative, you know, was very much involved with going to these marches in the different cities in a supportive way, in some cities helping initiate, others just showing up and participating and promoting the march. And you know, these marches, the one that happened last week and the one happened a year ago, a little over a year ago, these are brilliant marches. And hopefully, you know, we're calling it a new women's movement. Hopefully it is. And we are, I mean, in a broad sense, of course it is, you know, we hope for, in a mass sense, of course it is a movement already out there. Question is, how will it grow? I heard a statistic that if you add up all the people, I think it was that at the recent marches, or maybe both marches together, the recent one and the one a year ago, you had like 1% of the population involved because they were so big. That's brilliant. What we can sort of report on from the ground in these marches is that there are a lot of women that were there, and men, who were basically, it's their first political steps into politics, you know, into real politics, people's politics, you know, popular progressive politics. And excuse me, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. And a lot of them, a decent number of them, were very interested in socialism, socialist ideas, how it all connected up, connecting the dots of the system and the repression that they were there to protest against. We got a great response. So you know, I'm not, what I'm about to say is about the aims of some of the leaders, the main leaders of the Women's March. It's not meant to discourage anyone from going or anything. I mean, that was just brilliant that there was a huge turnout, and people should be going to these marches. And I think they've had an effect. I think you know, it seems like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, I went to this protest and nothing happened. That's very rare, actually, you know? It's very rare, because the protest could be adding to a movement that's already existing. It could be starting one. They could, and believe me, they register on the minds and sort of intelligence writings and so-called intelligence writings and so on of the ruling elite, of the bourgeois, of the less than 1%. They are very much aware when people get out of the streets. You know, if you read a lot of the stuff, let's use the example of the Nixon administration for a second, because people have studied these, it could be any administration, any, you know, presidential administration of the United States, the way they closely follow protests. Nixon, you know, information that's been released, the Freedom of Information Act and so on, studying Nixon around the time of the anti-war movements and the other movements that spun out of that, they were very, very much aware of the protest movement in Washington or elsewhere, very, very much aware during the civil rights movement of the big protests, you know, Kennedy, Johnson, and so on, all the Democrats, the Republicans, they're all, they don't like these movements. The most sort of progressive, if you want to say that, or seemingly progressive of the Democratic Party, people like Sanders and so on, you know, Sanders is putting out some good issues, promoting some good issues like Medicare for all. There's other issues he's like supporting that are not good in terms of you know, aspects of U.S. imperialism and so on. But he's putting forward some very progressive economic demands that would, some of them would fit into sort of a social democratic or left wing social democratic type of program in Europe, you know. But of course, he's not doing it through a social democratic party or through any sort of workers' party. He's doing it through a corporate political party. But most importantly, even with Sanders, he's not organizing or trying to organize a mass movement. He's still shuffling people into the Democratic Party, or shuttling people into the Democratic Party, and pointing towards 2018. And before that, 2017, the special elections that had happened in November 2017, you know, so his whole thing is, as he said quite openly, to support Clinton when it came down to that, and then supporting bringing people in the Democratic Party to, quote-unquote, reform the Democratic Party, an old failed strategy. He knows better. I've met Sanders. He knows better than that strategy, but he's given up on the idea of building an independent, workers' party, something he was for in the past. He was for a third party, some sort of progressive third party in the past. He's no longer for that. And by past, I mean way past, about the 70s, 80s, into the 80s. He now supports the Democrats. And as a result, there's just that you can't have your cake and eat it too in this sense. The Democratic Party does not want to create a mass movement that would get out of its control, that would threaten its existence. It doesn't want to create a mass movement that would destabilize the system that they're making a lot of money off of. You know, they doesn't want to create a movement that might get out of its control in various ways. So. Even Sanders, who has given lip service to the idea that, well, I can put forward ideas, but it's really the people that have to carry them out. It has to be mass protests and so on. He'll say that. He'll talk the talk. He won't walk the walk. That's the problem. Others won't even talk the talk. They won't even say, hey, this is going to take a mass movement to settle. Instead, they just say, just vote for me and I'll deal with it. You know, I'll be, you know, Madame Pelosi in the back room wheeling and dealing, or Chuck Schumer wheeling and dealing, and as a result, no DACA. As a result, Trump in power. As a result, more deportations under Obama than even Trump. You know, as a result, drone strikes, proxy wars, just like under the Bush administration. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So, basically, you have a situation where the most sort of quote unquote. A radical of the Democrats, someone like Sanders, still afraid, still not putting resources into building a mass movement. But what's that you say? Sanders did create this thing called Our Revolution. Yeah, he did. That exists in about 4 states as far as a statewide group goes. And from what I've seen, they are supporting mostly Democratic Party politicians, maybe completely. Well, I won't say completely, because in Minneapolis, they did endorse social entrepreneur candidate Ginger Jensen, but at the same time, they endorsed Democratic Party candidates running in the same ward. So that was kind of weird and innocuous, and not innocuous, just weird and actually stupid. From what I've seen in races that they've touted as victories, they're talking about Democratic Party politicians. Who, when you look into it, as I have with some of them at least, I haven't looked into all of them, but the ones I have looked into without exception, they looked pretty mainstream to me. They looked pretty mainstream to me, the people that got elected. as supposedly Sandinistas or Our Revolution people. And that's still, even through Our Revolution, that's still an electoralist strategy. I use electoralist because that's the only strategy they're putting forward. Again, not putting forward a mass movement that could get out of the control of the Democrats, putting forward an electoralist strategy, which is the same thing the so-called establishment or more conservative Democrats are putting forward. So you're getting the same message essentially out of the Democratic Party from start to finish, from left to right, so-called left to right, which is elect Democrats and everything will be cool. Everything will be all right. And anyone that's lived for 5 minutes in this political system in the United States knows that's not true, that there's a political duopoly of the two parties. And as I've said, I think I said in the last show, but I'll say it just based on personal experience. If I was a pure empiricist and not a Marxist, I would say, okay, this regime was Democrat. They controlled the Congress and the presidency. First 2 years of the Clinton administration, first 2 years of the Obama administration, etc. Now, did I see fundamentally different policies under those administrations than I saw under the Republican administrations when they controlled, like now, all the seats? I saw differences? Sure. I mean, Trump's style. Trump harkens back to, you know, if you lived long enough to live through Reagan, then Trump doesn't surprise you totally. But Trump, Reagan, other yahoos. In American politics, you've seen it. If you're as old as I am, hopefully, if you're not, you've read about it at least. But you know, it seems different. It seems completely different to some people. Trump is a completely new animal. look at his policies. They're not that new. There were corporate tax cuts by Democrats in the past. Massive corporate tax cuts. Because think about it, there's a fact that a lot of sort of left-wing people know about, I think, which is that even under capitalism, even under the post-war upswing, you had individual income tax as high as 90% plus under the Eisenhower administration in the 50s, which is considered a very conservative decade in retrospect. You know, that was quickly dismantled starting, I don't know when it started, but definitely accelerated during the Kennedy administration and on through. So the corporate tax rate, for example, wasn't always 35% or 34-something percent, as it was when Trump just recently lowered it. And by the way, what's all this stuff about this is permanent? No, it's not permanent. A new regime could come in and just increase the tax rate on corporations. But what I'm getting at is that when the new regimes come in, when a Republican comes in after Democrat, or Democrat comes in after Republican, you don't see a dismantling of the fundamental changes that happened, right? You don't. You see new priorities, perhaps. You see a tinkering here and there. But you don't see, right? You don't see all like the things that they most vociferously campaigned against eliminated. You know, and I'm mainly thinking of Democratic Party regimes after Republican regimes. But it works the other way, too. People think that Trump is now dismantling a lot of stuff that the Obama administration had set up or whatever. And that's true to a certain extent. But look what's happened. It was only on the tax thing that he got a victory. And why is that? Because even though the Democrats voted against it, they actually like aspects of the tax, including the corporate tax cut. So they didn't, again, as is their nature, they did not try to organize a mass movement against it. But even on the backroom level, even on a political level of other pressures they could bring to bear through their control of the media and so on, parts of the media, they didn't go after some of the basic premises of Trump administration's tax policies. And therefore, that issue came and went pretty quick. It'll come back in various ways, but possibly not through the Democrats. But anyway, I just wanted to assure listeners that, you know, Social Alternative is not the only people out there thinking that, hey, Democratic Party's no way forward, despite what the leaders of the Women's March tried to pound into people's heads both last year and this year. So this is from Amir Kavagi from Counterpunch, quote, marching into the arms of the Democrats. Again, if you were listening a few minutes ago, I preface this with yay women's marches in terms of turnout, in terms of idea, in terms of initialization, in terms of the response we got there, Social Alternative and so on. Though, you know, the people participating, all great, but still the question will come up in any movement: what do you stand for? What do you want people to do? What is to be done? What's next? What are our demands? Or should we not have demands, et cetera, et cetera. So on that level of, you know, what these marches could be doing versus what they are, which is channeling people to the Democratic Party, seems to be the main demand. That is not enough, and that is actually counterproductive. So just so you know, we're not the only one saying that. Amir Kavagi, January 23rd, 2018, Counterpunch. Quote, this past weekend, thousands of protesters marched in the streets of Manhattan to commemorate the first anniversary of last year's Women's March on Washington. It was an unprecedented, incredible march to amount to the largest single day of protest in American history. Progressive-minded people from around the country took part in a day of outrage against the misogynist and racist symbolism of what Trump represents. By the way, I'm not sure it was the greatest single day protest in American history, but I have to research that. The protest was not only poured down the streets of Washington, but occurred simultaneously in cities around the globe. It was indeed a remarkable achievement in mass political mobilization and organization. So that's, you know, we agree with that. Then, yet for all its admirable achievements, this year's Women's March, still probably will end up at best selling us a bag full of hollow symbolism and at worst selling us out to the Democratic Party. Last year, as I watched the demonstration march in New York, I wondered out loud to a friend that if Clinton would have won, would we be even seeing a Women's March? Some activists left the march feeling disillusioned, by the fact that even though hundreds of thousands of people took part in a single day of mass action, there was little in the way of providing concrete demands or even long-term coordinated action. This year, the organizers were prepared to change that. According to the Women's March organizers, this year's march was designed to build momentum for its, quote, power to the polls, end quote, campaign. There you go. That's what they're calling coordinated action and concrete demands, but it's not, unfortunately. The campaign will officially launch on January 21st in Las Vegas with a specific goal of initiating a national voter registration drive. As stated on their website, organizers are aiming to target swing states to register new voters, to engage impacted communities, harness our collective energy, etc. That all falls under from their point of view, the rubric of the Democratic Party, quote, collaborating with our partners to elect more women and progressive candidates to office, end quote. Leaders of the Women's March are obviously trying to use their brand to influence the upcoming midterm elections. Linda Sarsour, a co-chair of the Women's March, was quoted as saying on their website, this campaign will mobilize a new group of activists to create accessible power to our voting polls, end quote. The power that they seem to be describing is vague and symbolic. Although it's downright passive, actually, he says, this is the author, it's downright passive and inept. Nowhere on their website did they mention any criticism of the role of the two-party system in maintaining a capitalist economic and political system that thrives from oppression and exploitation. At the very least, you won't find any mention of the devastating effects that neoliberalism has caused for millions of working class women throughout the country as well as in the global South. Both parties, by the way, jointly endorsed and enacted neoliberal policies happily arm in arm. Nor will you find any mention of protesting militarization or imperialism. Or are those not important women's issues? He questions. And yet the most important piece missing from their entire platform is the central roles that class and race play in the oppression and exploitation of working class women. The entire notion of class is invisible to Women's March organizers, while the centrality of race is watered down. Excuse me. So I don't have time to read the whole thing, but this is an article I would recommend reading. Don't necessarily agree with all of it, but it's quite good. He goes out and says, essentially, the Women's March ideology snugly fits into the ideology of neoliberalism. They have no intention on challenging the neoliberal ideology that dominates our society. Instead, their game plan is to fight for a more, quote, inclusive, end quote, neoliberalism. A more inclusive neoliberalism. You can call it intersectional neoliberalism. Ideologically, they believe if they channel their supporters' energy and enthusiasm to the ballot box next November, they will somehow achieve lasting, quote, transformative change, unquote. For the Women's March, transformative change will come from all hands on the deck support for the Democratic Party. The same party, by the way, that was responsible for rigging the Democratic primary against Sanders. It was the same party that nominated neoliberal warmonger Clinton for presidency. It was the Democratic Democrat Obama who was responsible for the Wall Street bailouts, the deportation of more people than ever, and than every, I'm sorry, previous presidency combined, and the massive increase in military conflicts around the world. Yes, that is the same party that the Women's March wants us to support. According to the organizers, our ultimate power is derived from our ability to vote. By continuing to vote for Democratic candidates, we are complicit in supporting the same unequal system that we should be trying to fight. Voting itself is not powerless. It can be an effective revolutionary tool. If radical progressive-minded people were to unite and form a revolutionary people's party, or even just back third parties that already exist, like the Green Party, it would radically change the status quo. Working-class people can't be expected to share the same party with the likes of Wall Street. Our interests are fundamentally in conflict and should be in opposition to Wall Street interests. Marxist writer and thinker Joe G.K. agrees, adding that the two-party system is a system, that the parties operate in tandem, that the role of the Democratic Party is to be the lesser of the two evils, to move to the left when masses begin to become radicalized so as to prevent the formation of a true people's party. In that sense, the theory of the lesser of two evils is the greatest evil. Yet the Women's March is mute when it comes to supporting the formation of a third party. They haven't even backed a third party progressive like Jill Stein, who also happens to be a woman. Instead, we are told that the best way to change the system is to continue to support the system. Instead, we are told that the way to change the system is to continue to support the system. Maybe if we play identity politics and elect candidates who look like us and share our quote-unquote values, we are told then we will be on the road to progress. The problems and limitations of identity politics are that it makes identity, not class, the central defining feature of one's politics. It was not Obama's racial identity that is responsible for leaving the system of mass incarceration intact. It was his class that shaped his political identity. It's tantamount to what writer Kianga Yamada Taylor has dubbed, quote, black faces in high places, end quote. Taylor writes that, quote, we have more elected black officials in the United States than any point in American history, yet for the vast majority of black people, life has changed very little. Black elected officials have largely governed in the same way as their white counterparts, reflecting all the racism, corruption, and policies favoring the wealthy seen through the mainstream media's politics, seen through mainstream politics. This highlights various limitations of voting solely based on a shared identity. Just because they might look like us doesn't mean they will be responsive of our working class movements. In that regard, the Women's March offers nothing new in terms of fundamentally changing our political or economic system. Historically, social movements have constantly tried to, have constantly put their fate in the hands of the Democratic Party. So in other words, historically, social movements have constantly put their fate in the hands of the Democratic Party, only to watch as their movements wither away. Have we learned nothing from the aftermath of Jesse Jackson's failed presidential campaign and his Rainbow Push coalition? The coalition led by Jackson firmly believed that they could change the party, the Democratic Party, from the inside. However, over the course of Bill Clinton's administration, poor and working class people, especially for blacks, were faced with such crises like the end of the welfare and the expansion of mass incarceration. Writers Aaron Gupta and Steve Horn have called the Democratic Party, quote, the graveyard of social movements, unquote. It is the definition of insanity. Oh, if the definition of insanity is to always do the same thing over and over again and expect different results, supporting the strategy of a women's march is insane. They have become essentially, perhaps as they always were, an extension of the Democratic Party. It's the same old lousy gift, this time wrapped in pink. Thankfully, progressive voices have emerged, critiquing the structure, leadership, and direction of the Women's March organization. And then he gives a few examples. I don't have time to get into. And just he finishes up the article saying, we can't continue to depend on the Democratic Party to protect us from the evils of the Republicans unless we want to continue to be used as a pawn in the two-party game. Poor and working-class people of all genders will never be liberated if we keep joining coalitions and parties with the very people who have vested interests, in maintaining our oppression. It's time to wake up and see that we are being herded into the trap that has kept us poor and exploited in the first place. It's time to say, time's up, the Democratic Party, and the time's up for the two-party system. That's by Amir Kavagi, K-H-A-F-A-G-Y. He's a self-described Arab Rican and New Yorker. He's well-known as an activist, journalist, writer, performer, and spoken word artist. Amir is currently pursuing a master's degree in urban affairs at Queens College. He can be reached at amirkavagi@gmail.com. So I thought that was a good article. I also just wanted to point out that, you know, there's a thing in politics, especially from a Marxist perspective, political economy perspective, that if you look at the mass organizations in society, like a mass political party, especially one that like the Democratic Party is supposed to be the lesser evil, the party that will pander more towards left-wing populism or populist ideas in general, the ruling class wants people to perceive that's as far as you can go. That's the most you can expect. You know, don't get your hopes up too high, et cetera, et cetera. But this is some sort of change with the Democrats. Of course, while the corporations fund both parties, while the policies that are turned out are very similar, and when a period of a whole history can be revealed of how the Democratic Party co-opted social movements and smaller political parties that were more radical, more to the left, into its fold, and then use them to basically increase the power of big business. But here's the qualifier. There are times when, some Marxists will say, some socialists will say, but people have to go through that experience, like here in the U.S. we're talking about, but it could apply to other countries. People have to go through that experience of the Democratic Party selling them out before they are ready to try something new. And you have to take into account all the pressures of the corporate media and so on. And, you know, I think there are moments in history where that's true, but I think we've gone through too many moments of history, too many, for for this to be like a completely new question. The role of the Democratic Party, as I think is evinced, as I think there's evidence of in the polling data, with Trump in power, the Democrats should be wildly popular. And they're not. Now, that doesn't mean people won't hold their nose and vote for them in 2018, maybe 2020 as well. But that's a different, that's the dynamic they've set up with a political duopoly, the Democrats, Republicans. It doesn't mean a lot of people, I mean, you can't be a member of the Democratic Party, by the way. There's no membership. And so if you're just, it's just a political affiliation, a voting designation, then I'd say that's pretty superficial, especially based on changing conditions in U.S. society and so on. Therefore, but the point I'm leading up to is that a lot of people have already gone through the betrayals of the Democratic Party again. Some people have gone through that and not learned a darn thing. Jesse Jackson still supports the Democratic Party, for example. Now, I'd argue that with people like Jesse Jackson, there's material reason for that, material interest. As a wealthy person, got getting wealthy through the structure of the Democratic Party, being affiliated to that, being able to use the networking and the connections, et cetera, of that. But there are a lot of people that are just normal average workers who have seen through the Democratic Party already. And even millennials, even very young people, I don't really like that term millennials, but I'm just saying as a reference, even very young people that are voting for the first time or second time have already seen through the Democrats. And there is a section of that out there. There's also that section that, yeah, they haven't quite learned their lesson yet. They're open to learning a lesson on it in the future, but right now they're just going to hold their noses and vote a certain way. And the problem is that gets institutionalized. That becomes a lifelong habit, especially the dilemma of without a workers' party growing and having some sort of power, people don't want to quote-unquote risk their vote on something that can't have an immediate, from their point of view, gain, which is a huge, huge mistake because obviously you have to organize something. When you're organizing a political party, a union, I don't know, even a bridge club or something or chess club or whatever, you obviously have to do the organizational work to get a certain number of bodies in the room so it's going to work. And that requires talking to people, explaining why this is important for your time, blah, 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 you know? It doesn't happen full-blown overnight. What seems spontaneous in politics almost never is. And yet people are taught to think that they're wasting a vote if their vote is helping to build something for the future. And that's a real horrible mistake people on the left make. It's a horrible mistake also for people who don't vote, because it's possible in certain elections to find something to vote for that is to the left of the Democratic Party. And in a socialist society or in a socialist movement, voting is extremely important. People need to be really voting a lot on things, but things more profound than you're allowed to vote for under capitalism. Another article I want to turn people on to, not really going to have time to get into it, I don't think, is let's put that, what do we have queued up here? Hold on one second. I just want to check something here. Okay, we're not going to put that on. Okay, we're all set. Not going to have time to go into this, but it's a very interesting graphic, kind of cruel, actually. Donkey in a Hole, this is the title. Donkey in a Hole, quote, "Don't expect Democrats to change much in 2018," by Danny Haifong, BAR contributor. BAR stands for Black Agenda Report. It's from January 10th, 2018. Now, I highly recommend, as I have on the show before, Black Agenda Report. They have podcasts. They have a website, put out essays. And leather politics, I think, is very close to Socialist Alternative. I really admire a lot of their writing and what they're doing. And this is a pretty good article. And it's basically about the 2018 elections, which we're into 2018. Talks about Doug Jones, as we did earlier. Mentions what I just mentioned about the low approval rates of the Democratic Party, despite the obvious crimes of the Trump administration. I don't have time to go into much of it, so I want to pick out what might be the best parts. And, I'll just go for the conclusion here real quickly. Democratic Party leaders hope that Biden and other corporate Democrats will see their stock rise in the coming 2018 elections. party leadership has invested much of nearly 2 years waging a two-headed war against progressive politics in the United States in the guise of the so-called Russian probe. The ongoing Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into so-called Russian influence interference in 2016 has both intensified the U.S. imperialist war against Russia and its allies and saw significant consequences for the U.S. left. Google and Facebook have changed their algorithms to suppress content from sites such as the American Herald Tribune, Black Agenda Report, and RT. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein has also become a target of the anti-Russian campaign. Yet the U.S. maintains legal presence along the Russian border and in Syria under the false pretense that Russia is legally occupying its own sovereign territory and that of its allies. So there's that little sort of counter-narrative to the Russian influence stuff that I thought was interesting. And then back to the main points. The Democratic Party has repressed the left, simultaneously pushed for war. And that's in keeping with recent history of the Democratic Party. I would say, he says recent history, I'd say entire history in a lot of ways. But anyways, what has been called Russiagate is nothing but a further slip down the rightward slope. The Democrats have been sliding in for decades. Anti-Russia hysteria is a desperate attempt to move progressive and radical forces to the gates of the Democratic Party's graveyard of social movements, etc. And last but not least, because of time, U.S. elections are shoved down the people's throats because the ruling circle needs the growing number of impoverished, mainly black, masses to identify with the possibility of reform from above. This becomes even more fundamental since the system is currently incapable of reform that provides any benefit to the people. There were several periods in U.S. imperialism's history when concessions were granted in response to the fight back of oppressed people, both here and abroad. The only reforms possible in this stage of the system are the ones completely opposed to the well-being of the people. Cosmetic changes may occur, but the general path of stagnation, poverty, war will remain constant until imperialism is finally laid to rest by a new just societal arrangement. So that's Danny Haifong, Black Agenda Report. Don't agree with everything there, but I like a lot of it. Bits of the article didn't have time to read that are really worth reading. And we're out of time. So thanks for listening to Social Alternative Radio. And the new semester is starting, but let's assume for now we're keeping our own schedule. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks again with talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And keep up the struggle. Check out socialalternative.org and give a listen to our song on the way out.
Lost my Valentine. You could never keep my meaning straight. Time of day.